We'll move to our next case, which is Bivens versus Trent. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Burks. We are here this morning asking that this court reverse a grant of summary judgment. The primary question in this case is an issue that has come up frequently before this court since the Supreme Court decided the decision of Garcetti versus Sabalos in 2006, and that is exactly what are the parameters of the Garcetti decision. In this particular case, Mr. Bivens filed a union grievance. He filed a grievance about workplace conditions.
So what happened to the grievance?
The grievance was denied.
Well, what did the union do? You say he filed a union grievance. What does that mean?
Well, he filed a grievance. The grievance, I believe, was presented to the union. The union then presented it. The grievance was denied. Ultimately, there was what Mr. Bivens requested.
The company denied it.
Well, the state police denied it at the first stage.
Now, I would just to follow up on that. What's the process followed here? You say he filed it. Is there a union representative that receives these grievances?
I believe that it would have been a union representative who would have filed the grievance on his behalf.
He would have taken it to the state police, somebody or something.
I believe that that is correct, Judge Mannion.
The reason I ask that, I'm just wondering to what kind of a hearing or formal procedure is, because normally I think at the initial stage of a grievance, you give it to a union representative or somebody who carries it on to someone else. It may not make a huge case out of it, but whatever it is, it was denied. But at the same time, with this one, they looked further and decided they're going to clean up the range.
And Judge Manning, you are correct in to the extent that I believe that the grievance was formally denied.
Well, is there a further round? What is this? Now, presumably, this is not under the National Labor Relations Act. I don't think that covers police forces. So
no.
Is there some state, Labor Relations Act applicable to police unions?
I believe that it could have, I don't want to say this definitively, but I believe that it could have gone to the State Labor Relations Board. Mr. Burks might know the answer to that question.
What was it? Was it?
No, it was not, Judge Posner. And I think that
it was totally internal, it sounds like to me.
Oh no, there's no question about that, Judge Mannion.
The
complaint was pursued internally. This was not something that was taken to an external body. I mean, the union, whether it is considered an external body or not, the union officials are state police employees. So, the communications would have been within people who are employed by the Illinois State Police. That is correct. But I also don't think that it is dispositive as to the First Amendment issue. The Supreme Court, and we can go back to the Javon case, the Supreme Court has said, and this court has said, that merely because something is purely an internal matter, that does not render it outside of the protection of the First Amendment. And in Garcetti, the Supreme Court specifically said that the previous decisions going back to Pickering and following through were all incorporated.
But Bivens was responsible for the safety of the shooting range. So why wouldn't that be squarely governed by Garcetti?
Because it's where the speech was made, Judge Posner. And this speech was made through a union. It was not the Garcetti ruling says that speech that is made pursuant to job duties is not protected. Jimmy Bivens had no obligation to go to his union to try to get the union and the union grievance procedure to rectify or remedy this situation. Now, did he have an obligation to report it? He probably did. I mean, he was in charge of the safety of the range, and he did report it. But this is a different issue. This is going a different avenue. And I think that
I don't understand. So are you saying that Garcetti doesn't apply if someone who is, responsible for reporting some problem repeats it to a newspaper?
I am saying that the initial...
Is that your position?
Yes, but may I clarify, please? The initial prong of Garcetti, and this court has said that it creates a new first prong in the First Amendment analysis. The first prong of the First Amendment analysis, it would not be barred by Garcetti. Now, you get to the balancing factors, and that could create a different issue as to whether or not the speech...
Didn't Garcetti go public with his...
No,
complaint?
He did not.
He didn't?
No, he did not, Judge. This was a internal memorandum that Garcetti, who was a prosecutor, had written. The memo was he was a desk-duty prosecutor. He had to make a recommendation. His job duties required that he make a recommendation. He made the recommendation. He forwarded up the chain of command. Those are the facts of Garcetti. And I think that actually the issue that you addressed was it was discussed in one of the dissents in Garcetti, and I believe that it was Justice Stevens's dissent. And I think what Justice Stevens said, that the ruling in Garcetti was illogical, because what it would do is it would protect someone who went to a newspaper or who blew a whistle very loudly, but it would not protect an individual who exposed that same conduct internally. And so... That was one of the rationales that I believe it was Justice Stevens offered for rejecting the Garcetti approach. So in going back to your question, Judge Posner, I believe that if somebody went to the media, then the Garcetti decision would not eliminate that from First Amendment mm-hmm. protection. What might eliminate it is the balancing factors that you get to down the road. But the Garcetti is the first hurdle that has to be overcome. And what the court wrote, what the district court said in this case, the probably the most significant ruling was his speech in this case was directly and inextricably related to his official duties at the range. Well, this standard of being related to his duties is different than the standard that is articulated in Garcetti, which is a standard of pursuant to one's job duties. And again, there have been a number of cases, even post-Garcetti, where people have spoken out about issues that they would have no idea about those issues if it were not for the nature of the work that they perform. Those cases have still, in many circumstances, contended that they are protected speech under the First Amendment.
What was the sequence of events? And one of the things that he was, obviously he had, was concerned about his own health initially. That's what he was noticing. He wanted, I guess, at some point he was going to get a blood test, and there was a question of who's going to pay for it.
That's correct. There was an issue as to how it was going to be paid. I think ultimately he paid for the test and was told to reimburse it.
I think that's what they were sort of told, that's what you do. Was that part of the grievance? A concern about his health and who's going to take care of him, and that he brings in these other things about the conditions of the range vis-a-vis his own health.
Well, and I think that gets us, Judge Mannion, to the second question, and is this speech on a matter of public concern? And clearly, within his grievance, and the grievance is reprinted in our appendix, there are certainly a number of references to the injuries that he personally has sustained. There's no question about that. But that is not the standard that this court has articulated. And the question is there a public component to it? And we have to understand this was one of two ranges, indoor ranges, that the Illinois State Police have in the state of Illinois. Many local police departments used it. It was used by hunters to set their sights. There were classes taught in there. There were a number of members of the public who utilized this range outside of the Illinois State Police. And I think what's important is the remedy that Mr. Bivens requested in his grievance. And that's the last thing he said, but what he said was, remedy requested, this range be professionally analyzed, cleaned, and repaired in such a manner as to render the facility safe of any health hazard with the prospect of reoccurrence minimal. Now, that remedy that he has requested is not purely a personal remedy. In fact, Mr. Bivens ultimately never even went back and worked in the range. Mm-hmm. That is a remedy that would provide a benefit not just to Mr. Bivens and not just to Illinois State Police officers, but also to the public at large. I see that my time has
expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Baker. Mr. Burks?
Thank you. My name is Paul Burks. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the defendants. The plaintiff here just conceded, I believe, or acknowledged that Mr. Bivens had an obligation to speak when he found out or discerned that the range was unhealthy.
But he didn't have an obligation to speak to the union.
He didn't have an obligation to file a grievance, but he did have an obligation to bring the concern to the attention of his superiors.
Yeah, but Mr. Baker is arguing that makes his point in some other form, not just talking to his superiors, then it becomes protected speech.
But a grievance is just talking to your superiors. It's just a formalized way in a unionized employment context to talk to your superiors. It's the same thing that a non-union employee would do if he had a grievance or an injury or something had gone wrong in his workplace and wanted to make a complaint about it. He would go to his superiors. In a unionized workplace, you do it through a formalized mechanism. But for First Amendment purposes, complaining to your supervisor about the conditions of your work is not... there's no First Amendment distinction between a unionized employee and a non-union employee. Who does that?
What about it? Your opponent doesn't argue it, but what I find is a little troubling. What about the argument that he's been retaliated against for petitioning for a redress of grievances, which is another clause of the First Amendment? Because he goes through the union. He's trying to get he has a grievance against the police department. Well, maybe doesn't it? Well, yes, a grievance against the police department, right, that they're not sufficiently attentive to the safety problem. That's why he filed a grievance.
That's true. That's the name.
Okay, so he's complaining to the government. Why isn't that a petition for redress of grievances?
What it is in this context is a state labor law question under the Illinois State Labor Relations Act, which does...
It doesn't matter. It's the government. You know, you're asking the government... You're asking the union to ask the government to do you have a grievance because of the safety of your workplace.
I think that those questions have always been adjudicated really under the statutory protections, which are probably more extensive than the first of all, I'll concede my lack of knowledge really on the standards that would be applied on a claim for retaliation for...
But that's never come up in the case. There's never been a reference to that clause
there
in the Constitution.
I'm going to presume that the statutory protections that are provided to union employees to exercise their grievance rights, their rights under the Act, are probably, and I don't know this for sure, more extensive than those that would constitute the constitutional claim if one had been presented here. So that's probably why those claims tend to be resolved within the State Labor Relations Act context. I'll point out another thing about a grievance, which is that it's only available to employees. So if the fundamental question under Garcetti is, was Mr. Bivens speaking as an employee or a citizen, and what he did is use a form of speech that's available only to an employee, no citizen can use the grievance procedure, it would weigh more in favor of finding that he was speaking as an employee when he filed the grievance, not as a citizen. And the third point I would make about the grievance is that it's a creature of the collective bargaining agreement, which and what he asserted was that there was a violation of the working conditions to which he was entitled, to the safe working conditions. So that's very much a complaint about private workplace conditions, and one would really only use the grievance procedure to raise that kind of an issue because that's the only kind of an issue that's cognizable in that context. So you have a procedure that's really only designed for employees, and it's designed to substitute for an informal complaint procedure.
Has he made any state law claims?
No, there are no state law claims.
Because there is a right, if you're fired in retaliation for complaining about safety, isn't that a violation of Illinois law?
There might be a public policy exception.
Yeah, isn't that the public policy exception?
There does exist a public policy exception. It has to be very narrow, very well-defined public policy.
But that's never been raised.
No, and partially because we remediated the range. I mean, the day he filed the grievance, we were already put the course of conduct in place to have it cleaned, have it shut down for 6 months, have it cleaned, and then reopen. So, you know, these contentions that we were embarrassed by these disclosures, it's simply not borne out by the record. We were pleased to hear. I mean, that.
I don't think the police were pleased to have to close the thing for 9 months.
Certainly not. I definitely misspoke. We were not pleased with the problem, but we were pleased that it was reported to us in a timely manner so that it could be corrected, and the record would bear that out. Referring quickly, I think, to the qualified immunity defense, I think, I mean, if this is a close constitutional question with respect to the union grievance, which, for the reasons I articulated, we really don't think it is, if it's a close one, we would rely on the defense of qualified immunity that there are no cases that say that a union grievance is constitutionally different than any other than a workplace complaint of a non-unionized employee, and we would have no reason to believe that was the case at the time that we took our action. So the qualified immunity defense, I think, would be a backstop in that circumstance.
In the grievance, he refers to violation of Article 1 of the usage working conditions. Is that some kind of a rule or regulation or something?
He's referring to Article 1 of the collective bargaining agreement, which says we will keep working conditions safe. We'll keep safe working conditions for all the employees.
Well, it seems to me, I'm just looking at the grievance, he's complaining about his blood level. He says that he wants that Costa Hayes or whatever it is, and he says that he's not been able to get any reply about a cleanup effort or a plan to make the District 2 range a safe and clean environment in which to conduct training, which is what he does. So now he's filing this grievance, and it's apparently because under a violation of the collective bargaining agreement. That doesn't seem to be an expression beyond the confines of this place as matters of public concern, and he seems to be concerned about his own condition and the atmosphere within which he has to work.
I think that's correct. I think what you need is somebody who's speaking as a citizen on a matter of public concern. What we have here is somebody who's speaking as an employee on a matter of private concern, on a matter of concern as to his own workplace conditions. I think there was dicta in one of the very early cases, Connick, where the court said we don't want to constitutionalize the employee grievance. And here, 30 years later, we're faced with a case that literally asks us to constitutionalize the employee grievance, a grievance filed by an employee internally complaining about workplace conditions pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement, which only went to his direct supervisor. There could be few types of speech that would be more internal to the employment situation and matters of more private concern than that.
But it seems that police immediately reacted to this or whatever and closed the place down for 9 months while they cleaned it up.
That's correct. I mean, there are officers who train in there regularly. So if there was a problem, and Mr. Bivens suggested that there was through his own blood test, there might be a problem here. And so they reacted quite rapidly to it. It was significant.
Well, of course, he does, I guess, look at being constructively discharged and that sort of thing. We've got that to deal with as well, right?
The retaliation claim?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as retaliation, the problem with his retaliation claim is he really does rely only on the timing. I made this grievance, and then these things happened. But the problem is that he made the grievance, and then he stopped coming to work. And so other things happened at the same time. And those other things, his refusal to come to work, notwithstanding doctor's orders that he should report back to work, his use of excessive benefit time, his inability to stay at work, these are legitimate, non-discriminatory, non-First Amendment-related reasons.
I thought he did come back to work for a little while after his disability payments were terminated, and then he did come back for a short time.
He was asked to come back to work in May of 2004, and he came back to work in January of 2005.
And stayed for about 9 months, right?
Stayed for about
and
9 months
he quit.
At that point.
And he stopped coming.
Or he stopped coming, and that's right. He stopped coming at that point and went on disability.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burke. You. Mr. Baker, you have anything further?
I know I only have, my time's expired, so just two brief points, if the court might indulge me. Judge Posner, as to your question about state law claims, if we were to file a retaliatory discharge claim, first of all, there was no actual discharge, and so the Illinois State Supreme Court has said there has to be an actual retaliatory discharge. There is no such tort as retaliatory constructive discharge. Mm-hmm. And also the state would claim sovereign immunity from any suit, and it would have to go to the Court of Claims. Judge Mannion, as to a point that you have brought up repeatedly, I think that the Oriema case is somewhat instructive. In Oriema, the plaintiff filed a civil lawsuit, a Title VII lawsuit. This court, in an en banc decision, decided that speech was protected, even though the only benefit of that lawsuit would have been to benefit that individual plaintiff.
It was filed in a public forum, though.
It was filed in a public forum, but that doesn't, you know, when we get to the second prong of the analysis of whether it is a matter of public concern, that doesn't necessarily address the forum of where it is filed.
Well, sure, it's a matter of public concern. I don't think there's any question about that. It's just a question of whether he's put it in the public domain. There's a lot of things that are, whether it be schools or anything else, that are matters of public concern. But he's expressing his own concern for his own health, which affects everyone else. As your opponent just said, yeah, well, these are all state police. They all shoot there. Let's clean this place up.
I think it's important, though, to understand that the fact that he spoke internally and his grievances were purely internal does not render that unprotected by the First Amendment. And we can look at the Supreme Court decision of Javon. We can look at Rankin versus McPherson. These are both Supreme Court cases where everything was internal, and yet the speech was fully protected. I know I've extended my time,
okay,
and I really
no, that's
it.
Fine. Thank you very much, gentlemen, both counsel. Next case for our